All right, everyone, welcome back to the deep dive. You know us, we love getting into the nitty-gritty of things that really matter right here in our neck of the woods. That's Deer Park, La Porte, Pasadena, for those just tuning in. And today we're tackling something that could seriously shake up how we live and build our communities.
It's this concept called missing middle housing, and we've been poring over a lecture by Dan Paralek. He's a big name in urban design, architect, and the brains behind Optico's design.
Right. And what's interesting is this Dan Paralek, he's not just some ivory tower architect. This guy's all about making our towns and cities more livable, more equitable. He designs innovative housing and wants to reform those zoning rules that can be a real headache when you're trying to create, walkable, vibrant neighborhoods.
He actually wrote a whole book on this. It's called Missing Middle Housing: Thinking Big and Building Small to Respond to the Housing Crisis.
Yeah. And you know what really caught our eye? Paralek mentioned how housing costs in Atlanta have gone through the roof in just 6 years. Now, we might not be Atlanta, but we all know people right here in Southeast Houston feeling the squeeze too. So it gets you thinking, what can we actually do locally to tackle
Yeah,
this?
that's the million-dollar question, and that's what this deep dive is all about. We're going to unpack what missing middle housing means for us, why it's so important, and look at some real-world examples Paralek shared. We want to give you folks listening some concrete ideas about how this could play out right here at home.
So let's get down to brass tacks. What exactly is this missing middle housing everyone's talking about?
Well, Paralek really emphasized this point. If you walk through older neighborhoods, the ones built before World War II, you'll notice something interesting. There's often a really cool mix of housing types, right? A single-family home next to a small apartment building, a duplex down the street, maybe some townhouses. It's diverse. But the way our zoning laws have evolved over the past few decades, it's become really tough, almost impossible, to build that kind of variety today.
So we've had this period, what, like 50 years or so, where very little of this missing middle is actually getting built. What kind of buildings even fall under that umbrella?
Think of it like this. It bridges the gap between those standalone single-family homes that we see everywhere and those big apartment complexes popping up. It's that sweet spot of multi-unit or clustered single-family housing that fits in with the neighborhood but offers more choices. Duplexes, triplexes, fourplexes, courtyard apartments, townhouses that aren't those massive three-story ones with the awkward tuck-under garages.
Right. Okay, that makes sense. And Paralek makes a direct link between this lack of diverse housing and the affordability crisis we're facing.
Absolutely. When the only new housing going up is either big, expensive homes on huge lots or those large apartment buildings that don't always fit in, we're missing a huge chunk of the market. We're not catering to different lifestyles, different income levels.
He called it a perfect storm of factors that got us here. What are some of the things driving this?
Well, for starters, our population is changing. We have an aging population. More and more people are living alone. Their needs and preferences are different from the classic family in a detached suburban home.
And then there's the financial burden of housing these days.
It's really concerning. Paralek threw out some stats, and they're eye-opening. Huge percentage of both homeowners and renters are paying over 30% of their income on housing. Renters, it's often over 50%. That doesn't leave much for anything else, like food, transportation, healthcare. And it's not just a big city issue anymore. Smaller towns, right here in our area, are struggling to provide housing people can afford.
Now, he brought up a point that I thought was really insightful. Attainability versus feasibility. What's the difference there?
It's actually really smart. He said that zoning regulations often make it pretty easy for developers to build certain types of projects. They're feasible from a business perspective. Developers know the rules. The approval process is, relatively straightforward. But just because a project makes financial sense for a developer doesn't mean the housing will be priced so regular folks can afford it. The focus is on what's easy to build, not necessarily what the community needs.
So we could be building a lot, but not necessarily the kind of homes our neighbors and families need.
Exactly. And Paralek was adamant that we shouldn't be aiming for just basic shelter. We need high quality, livable spaces, places where people want to settle down and build a community. Right here in Deer Park, La Porte, Pasadena.
Absolutely. He then went into some fascinating case studies, real-world examples of these ideas in action. Let's start with the one in Salt Lake City, dealing with the single-family home industry.
So this is a cool example of how missing middle principles can actually change how traditional home builders do business. Homes, a big builder in Salt Lake, known for those larger suburban homes, they realized they had to adapt. They wanted to offer more affordable options than those cookie-cutter three-story townhouses we see everywhere.
And what did they come up with? The Muse housing concept in that Daybreak master plan.
That's it. They took those deep lots you often find in master planned communities and totally reimagined them. Instead of one house per lot, they divided them into smaller, more pedestrian-friendly microblocks. The key feature was a shared pedestrian walkway, the Muse, running through these blocks. It created a more intimate, connected feeling.
So it encouraged a more walkable, neighborly feel, even in a larger development. We could use more of that in some of our newer developments around here.
For sure. And design-wise, they flipped the script on the typical townhouse. Instead of a long, narrow unit with limited natural light, these units were deeper, about 26 feet. So natural light flooded in from the sides, making them brighter and more appealing with double-height spaces.
And the price was a big factor in making this model work, right?
Huge. They could offer these homes starting around $185,000, significantly less than those often less desirable tuck-under townhouses. Proof that good design and affordability don't have to be at odds. And this Muse model, it worked both for sale and for rent, showing its broad appeal.
It does make you think about all those, well, kind of bland townhouses popping up around Deer Park, La Porte, Pasadena. Maybe there are smarter ways to create affordability and better living spaces if we rethink our approach.
Couldn't agree more. We need to be asking ourselves, are we just accepting the easiest development model? Or are we using our planning and zoning tools to push for better, more diverse housing types that meet a wider range of needs for our residents?
Now, the next case study Paralek brought up was a lot more radical. A car-free community in Tempe, Arizona called Cul-de-Sac. This one's a real head-turner.
Oh, this was ambitious. A pilot community aiming to be the largest car-free development in the U.S. It started with a 16-acre site. They'd already approved a pretty standard 7-story project with huge parking garages, but it was never actually built. Not really feasible in the end.
So they had a blank slate to rethink how to use that land.
Exactly. And their big idea, the game changer, was this. Eliminate private car parking entirely. By doing that, they could fit almost the same number of units, around 700, in more human-scale 2- and 3-story buildings. And they could create higher quality designs and more communal space.
Wow, no parking at all. That's a pretty big shift, especially here in the Houston area where everyone's so car dependent. How did they make that work?
They really leaned into the local climate. Designed buildings and spaces that worked with it, not against it. They drew inspiration from those shaded walkways and courtyard buildings you find in historic cities in hot climates. They used what Paralek called a missing middle kit of parts. Simple building blocks, like bar and L-shaped structures, that could be arranged in different ways to create these interesting block patterns.
And the way they set up the units, it seemed like they really wanted to encourage accessibility and community interaction.
Oh, absolutely. They had ground floor flats designed for full accessibility, then 2-story townhouses above them, often with exterior stairways. This maximized density without those long, impersonal corridors you get in big apartment blocks.
Building a strong community seemed to be a core design principle for them.
Yeah, it was central. They made these smaller courtyards to encourage people to connect, chat, hang out, and provide shade, of course, in that Arizona heat. Instead of car-dominated streets, they had paseos, these narrow walkways where every unit had its own entrance. It really blurred the lines between private and public and brought people closer to the outdoors. The units themselves were kept shallow, about 16 feet deep. This ensured lots of natural light and good cross ventilation. More comfortable, more livable.
So it's not just about being car-free, but about creating a community that's rich in other ways to get around and connect.
Exactly. They're not just taking cars away. They're giving residents a whole package of mobility options. Discounted transit passes, car sharing, bike and scooter sharing, even dedicated delivery services for groceries and stuff. It's a whole different approach. And they involved landscape architects and retail consultants from the get-go. Even integrated public art from local artists all over the place, adding to the character.
Paralek called the buildings fabric buildings, which I found interesting. What did he mean by that?
Fabric buildings are about the architecture playing a supporting role. It defines and activates the public spaces without being too imposing or visually aggressive, creating a cohesive, welcoming environment. They looked at places like Barrio Viejo in Tucson and the work of Hassan Fathi, the Egyptian architect, for inspiration. And you know what? Despite the whole car-free thing being a pretty big change, there's a huge waiting list of people wanting to live there. Really positive response.
That's fascinating. It shows there's real demand for alternatives, for communities designed for people, not cars. We just need the vision and the courage to make them happen.
Agreed. Now, the next case study focuses on unit size and density. It's a project in Santa Maria, California, and it really got me thinking about our own density rules and what they actually allow.
They crammed 129 units per acre onto a small 80 by 72 foot lot using only 2- and 3-story buildings. That's dense, but still human scale. How'd they pull that off?
Their downtown-specific plan was key. They made a bold move, completely ditched traditional density caps in that area. Instead of limiting units per acre, they focused on regulating the form and scale of buildings. So it's not about a number, it's about how the building looks and fits in with the street and neighbors.
So more about the shape and how it interacts with the streetscape, not just cramming in as many units as possible?
Yes. And in this project, no unit was bigger than 350 square feet. Perelick argued there's a market for this smaller, more efficient type of housing almost everywhere. It can be a much more affordable way to live in desirable, walkable areas.
It makes you wonder how many zoning districts in Southeast Houston would allow that density over 100 units per acre while keeping building heights at 2 or 3 stories. Probably not many.
That's the question we need to ask ourselves. Our density-based zoning often assumes high density equals skyscrapers. It totally misses the potential of this missing middle approach, these house-scale, high-density options. Perelick even suggested getting creative with how we calculate density, maybe counting smaller units as fractions for zoning.
The fourth case study took us to Omaha, Nebraska, a project called Prairie Queen. They really tried to redefine multifamily housing.
Yeah, this one was inspiring. They took the missing middle idea and applied it to those big, often kind of boring suburban apartment complexes. They wanted something more appealing, something that felt like a real neighborhood, walkable, connected.
And their concept was really unique. Buildings that look like grand mansions from the outside, but with multiple units inside.
Right. They called it a missing middle neighborhood kit. It included everything from duplexes to 8-plexes spread across 40 acres, over 600 units, and it's been hugely successful, outperforming every other multifamily development in Omaha.
And that main street they created within the development, that seemed to be a big part of its success.
Totally. They included these flexible ground floor spaces for businesses, encouraging people to walk around, creating those neighborhood hubs. They even added ADUs above some parking areas, making the most of the space.
Their parking strategy was also different.
One off-street space per unit, the rest was on-street. And it worked. It challenges the idea that we need tons of off-street parking. The developer even said the city maintains the on-street parking, which is a nice perk. And their mansion apartment building was a perfect example of their concept, a multi-unit building that blends right into a traditional street.
I heard Opticos is putting these missing middle neighborhood kit prototypes online.
Yeah, they want to share these models so more developers and communities can use them, make it easier to implement these ideas and, you know, act locally.
Perelick also mentioned how missing middle housing can help with multi-generational living, which is becoming more and more common.
It's a growing trend, and missing middle is perfect for it. Instead of just tacking on ADUs to big suburban homes, missing middle allows for more thoughtful, integrated, multi-generational living in walkable neighborhoods with amenities. He gave an example. A main unit connected to a grandma's wing and a separate boomerang unit for a young adult, all around a shared courtyard. Connection and privacy at the same time.
Shifting gears a bit, Perelick talked about the public sector work Opticos does, helping communities create place-based frameworks. What's the idea there?
It's a move away from those rigid, outdated zoning models that so many cities still use. It's about creating plans that are rooted in the unique culture, geography, and character of a place. He compared it to using an old, clunky camera versus modern technology. Our zoning systems need an upgrade.
He even mentioned the link between old zoning practices and redlining, which is a stark reminder that things need to change.
It really highlights the need for zoning reform to address those historical inequities and make our communities more inclusive. The shift towards form-based codes, which focus on the look and design of buildings rather than just separating uses, is a big part of that.
Opticos has a method for helping communities adopt these place-based approaches, right?
They have a missing middle scan and a deeper deep dive. The scan identifies areas where missing middle could work best. The deep dive gives specific zoning and policy recommendations. They focus on teaching local planners how to understand and make the changes themselves, not just handing them a finished plan. They've seen this work in Greenville, South Carolina, and Greensboro, North Carolina. Their maps help shape those cities' comprehensive plans.
That test fits idea, trying out different development scenarios on typical lots, seems like a great way to find hidden zoning barriers.
It is. By visualizing what can actually be built under existing rules, they can spot those gaps between the rules and what's actually feasible or desirable. They found lots of cases where zoning unintentionally blocks missing middle housing, like requiring huge setbacks for multifamily buildings compared to single-family homes, making smaller multi-unit projects impossible on regular lots.
He also mentioned zoning toolkits for broader impact.
The idea is to go beyond individual plans for specific areas. Instead, create adaptable guidelines at the county or regional level. These toolkits, based on the Form-Based Codes book, offer a menu of zoning options that communities can pick and choose from. The Marin County Toolkit in California is a great example. 10 jurisdictions worked together, overcame some initial doubts, and got widespread adoption of design standards, even won an award. The toolkit had separate chapters, so each place could use what worked for them, and it was really successful.
And then there's those place-based comprehensive plans OptiCos works on.
These plans are a big-picture approach to planning. They incorporate placemaking, identify different types of places within a community, and often use form-based coding. OptiCos helped develop some award-winning plans, like Memphis 3.0 and Kauai County's plan. Memphis was really interesting. They collaborated closely with local experts, trained the city planners, and provided guidance. They focus on neighborhood anchors, like corner stores and churches, not just generic centers. It resonated with people. They also figured out how much change each area wanted, realizing that different neighborhoods have different needs. And it worked. A lot of the new investment went to those anchor neighborhoods. Kauai was similar, tailoring the plan to the island's unique character.
So these housing plans are the more specific actions that bring those comprehensive plans to life.
Exactly. They develop tailored strategies for different parts of the city. Modesto, California's plan, is a good example. They have different approaches for downtown, nearby neighborhoods, and suburban areas. They also make sure to explain how different housing types can fit different families and households. And as we've discussed, those test fits are crucial at this stage. They help planners see if missing middle options are feasible and affordable and adjust zoning accordingly. They also looked at underused commercial corridors as potential spots for missing middle. Importantly, their Sacramento study included an analysis of potential displacement risks, making sure new development benefits existing residents. And their Missing Middle Roadshow in Modesto was a cool way to get the community involved, answer questions, and build support.
He briefly touched on some partnerships OptiCos has, like with Habitat for Humanity and AARP.
Their work with Habitat for Humanity Sonoma County on those cottage court prototypes for wildfire recovery was great. Using pre-manufactured parts, trying different building methods to be faster and more efficient. Their partnership with AARP has been all about educating people about missing middle. Presentations, walking tours, planning exercises, even a publication showing how a single-family home could become a triplex without changing the neighborhood's character. And they work with the NAHB to analyze zoning across the U.S., seeing what helps and hinders diverse housing.
He ended with a call to action, comparing it to a Monopoly game. Everyone needs to play a part in fixing the housing crisis.
He did, and he brought back that statistic, that about 60% of all new housing we need by 2040 should be missing middle. He wants us to think less about abstract numbers like density and more about the actual types of buildings and how they shape our neighborhoods. He reminded us that most of us probably have some connection to missing middle housing, whether we realize it or not. Maybe it's that old apartment building or those townhouses nearby. His message was clear. Residents need to understand and support missing middle, architects need to design it, developers need to build it, and groups like AARP need to keep educating people. He also said that places like Atlanta, and by extension, Southeast Houston, have a limited time to act before these housing problems get even worse.
This deep dive into missing middle housing has been really eye-opening. We hope it's given you folks in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena a lot to think about as we plan our neighborhood's future.
It really boils down to this. Missing middle housing isn't just some theory. It's a practical way to make our communities more diverse, more affordable, and more walkable, right here where we live.
We encourage everyone listening to think about these examples and strategies. See how they might apply to your own streets and neighborhoods here in Southeast Houston.
What if we made one small change in our zoning or our priorities? Could that unlock the potential of missing middle housing here? Could we create a more vibrant, equitable, and sustainable future for Southeast Houston?
Understanding these ideas and talking about them is the first step to making a difference, and that's what Think and Act Locally is all about. If this deep dive resonated with you and you want to support us as we explore ways to improve our lives and community right here in Deer Park, LaPorte, and Pasadena, please visit thinkandactlocally.com/donate. You can find the link in the show notes.